loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we talk about two big stories. First, we'll talk about the dramatic early developments in the 2020 election race for the White House. Yes, it's already begun. And then it's our weekly series every Tuesday called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, last month, a U.S. Border Patrol supervisor in Texas was charged with murdering four women and attempting to murder a fifth. He'll be tried on capital murder charges. This alleged crime is extreme, but Border Patrol agents are arrested for committing crimes all the time. Just last year, 254 Border Patrol agents were arrested for drug and alcohol-related crimes, domestic abuse, abuse of power, and other crimes. Next, the Saudi government is preparing to announce that the death of journalist Jamal Khashoggi was an interrogation gone wrong. But some of the most powerful people in Washington say that admission isn't good enough, and they're calling for sanctions on Riyadh. Meanwhile, Saudi watchers say Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman may have gone too far in ordering the killing and may have put his own position in jeopardy. Then, 50 years ago, on October 16, 1968, black athletes Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their black-gloved fists in the air during the U.S. national anthem while on the medal podium at the Olympics. The third athlete on the podium was Australia's Peter Norman, who joined them in wearing a human rights badge on his uniform. The International Olympic Committee president threatened to ban the entire U.S. track team, and as a result, Smith and Carlos were expelled from the Games. And then the Russian Orthodox Church yesterday cut ties with the Ecumenical Patriarchate of Constantinople, the body seen as the spiritual authority of the world's Orthodox Christians. The row is seen as the greatest split in Christianity since the Orthodox and Catholic churches split in the year 1054. There's no disagreement whatsoever on dogma. Instead, the fight is over who should have authority over Ukraine's Orthodox, Russia or Constantinople. And finally, North and South Korea agreed on Monday to begin reconnecting rail and road links in another step toward improving bilateral relations, despite U.S. concerns over North Korea's nuclear arsenal. The two also began demining procedures in the demilitarized zone. And in other headlines, President Trump threatened to cut funding to Honduras if the country doesn't stop a caravan of migrants that has crossed into Guatemala headed toward the United States. Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez said last month that funding cuts would stymie their ability to decrease immigration. Former Obama administration cabinet secretary Julian Castro has announced that he is likely to run for president in 2020. He made the remarks to Rolling Stone, saying that he'll make a final decision after the midterm election. Castro served as housing and urban development secretary from 2014 until President Obama left office. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed announced a new cabinet today that is 50% composed of women ministers. This was the latest move by Ahmed to bolster his reformist credentials. Since taking office earlier this year, Ahmed has taken dramatic steps to resolve long-standing regional and internal conflicts. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison has raised the possibility of the country moving its embassy in Israel to Jerusalem, long claimed by Palestinians as their capital. Morrison said, quote, "We're committed to a two-state solution, but frankly, it hasn't been going that well. Not a lot of progress has been made, and you don't keep doing the same thing and expect different results," unquote. The United States opened an embassy in Jerusalem earlier this year, causing outrage. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and clear.
Now we turn to the U.S. election campaign. New reports from the Federal Election Commission show that Donald Trump has already raised over $100 million for the 2020 re-election campaign, a number unmatched in decades. Meanwhile, Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren has all but declared her intention to run for president. More than 2 years ahead of time, the race for the presidency is already well underway. We're joined from Atlanta by Anoa Changa. Anoa is the director of political advocacy and a managing editor of Progressive Army and the host of the show, The Way with Anoa. And we're joined from New York City by Ted Rall. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work at Rall.com. Anoa, Ted Rall, welcome.
Thank you.
Noah Cenga, well, $100 million, that's a lot of money. At the same time, obviously, Elizabeth Warren, through this DNA test, is signaling that she intends to run. What's your impression right now?
I don't think that's like really our signal that she intends to run. I think Warren has already been running. That was very clear to me being here in Georgia 21 days out from the election, you know, 21 days from today. It was very clear to me last week when Senator Warren appeared alongside Ayanna Pressley and Stacey Abrams in Clayton County, Georgia. There really is no valid reason. I mean, it's not like people can't come down to Clayton County if they want to, but there's literally no reason for Senator Warren, of all places in America to be in Clayton County, Georgia, unless she's running in 2020 and is trying to make sure she doesn't make the same mistakes as a white progressive from the Northeast that Bernie Sanders made in 2016. So to me, she's already been running. This, I don't know what her and her team were thinking with this, but I think strategically it was a mess and was not done very well. I know there have been varying response from people who are indigenous on social media and various articles and interviews that already happened. And so not being indigenous, I'm not going to express too much, but I think that even we're 3 weeks from a major election cycle. We have a lot of amazing candidates that are running on, you know, solid platforms who are transformative, not just because we have a wave of people of color, but just because they're really pushing issues and running campaigns that run counter to the prior narratives of the Democratic Party. It just seems like a better use of her time to help support that than do what she did with this back and forth with Trump. I mean, Trump is pulling the strings with Democrats in numerous ways, and this doesn't help do anything. This just feeds also into his racism regarding indigenous people. And you have folks like Paulette Jordan, who would be not only the first, I believe she'd be the first Native American governor, period, not only the first Native American woman governor, who's running for governor of Idaho, who in her interview herself, while she didn't, she had a very diplomatic and really appreciate her response as well. But she said that money that Trump had promised, really, they should find a way to redirect money into supporting Native American candidates who are running for right now. And I mean, you have her, you have Deb Haaland, you have Sharice Davids. I mean, there are quite a few people running right now, and that just seemed like a really poor way to handle this, in my opinion, on Senator Warren's part.
Ted Rawl, jump in.
I couldn't agree more. There was an article that appeared in either Boston Magazine or Massachusetts Magazine a few years ago about Elizabeth Warren, and it's worth looking up because it predicts this kind of behavior, this kind of tone deaf attitude that a lot of people in Massachusetts have already, particularly on the progressive side, already noted about her. The question is she really ready to run a national campaign? She's certainly venturing out of the Northeast, but she doesn't seem to have that certain intangible gravitas that you kind of need, and not to mention the sensitivities. I agree with Anil about the framing issue. You don't let Donald Trump frame the issue. Look at what happened when he accused Barack Obama of not being born in the United States, and then Obama did produce the birth certificate. Did that shut him up? No, he just moved on to the next thing.
Yeah, Noah, I'm looking at a tweet by Kim Tallbear, and it's a statement about Elizabeth Warren's DNA test. For Elizabeth Warren to center a Native American ancestry test as the next move in her fight with Republicans is to make yet another strike, even if unintended, against tribal sovereignty. It does sort of smack of that. And at the same time, Donald Trump successfully, I think, is able to, since she's raised this issue right now, as you said, right before the midterm elections, she's allowed Donald Trump to come back at her and say, you know what, you need to apologize to Native communities and indigenous communities. I mean, it's really something coming from Donald Trump. But nonetheless, she makes the issue again, because the issue about the issue for Elizabeth Warren is Elizabeth Warren. It's not about all these other issues that people actually care about. And that seems to me to be also the problem, where the Democratic Party doesn't seem to actually, as a party, stand for anything. Different individuals have a different orientation, of course. Bernie Sanders has come out with strong positions that are progressive, at least on domestic policy. I don't think very progressive at all, not progressive at all from my point of view on most international issues. But nonetheless, it's kind of a tried and true tactic for the Democratic Party that continues to help and contributes to the success of Donald Trump and of the right wing.
Yeah, I definitely think that there is something to be said and reflective. And this is also the problem, because we've had this fanatical, you know, reaction to Trump happening nationwide. And I'm not saying that the reaction we've had that we've seen the people is not like good. It just hasn't been structured, I think, in a way that is productive to leading towards successfully dethroning him, so to speak, in 2020. As it exists right now, because there hasn't even been an honest reflection and assessment of how people have engaged and dealt with Donald Trump across the election cycle, leading up into and through his election. I mean, we're still acting like we're dealing with someone where the regular rules of engagement apply. Like you, like the example before about Obama and the birth certificate. Like, I saw someone actually tweet this is someone who has demanded Democrats show a birth certificate and DNA testing and won't show his own taxes, right? Like, this is just like the regular schoolyard bully nonsense that we see. And you can't operate or act like he's acting in good faith the same way they have done with Republicans over the years, which, I mean, arguably has been a mistake anyway. But what I do think, I do not think that all hope is lost. I know, you know, we originally started out with an overview of how much Donald Trump has raised thus far already for 2020. I really don't care how much money he raises, right? I really don't care. I mean, he could raise all the money that exists in the universe. He could raise more money than Jeff Bezos. I really do not care. What I do care about is, are Democrats really going to take lessons from this cycle, from what we're seeing happening here with Stacey Abrams and Andrew Gillum and so many others, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, whatever issues we have people ideologically on issues, we do need to criticize and work through them and challenge, obviously. But there is something that's really powerful that's happening in terms of mobilizing people, even when we're being outspent. Right. When we look at Ayanna Pressley, like so many folks are doing this. We see this happening in local level races, like Kat Brooks running for mayor out in Oakland. We're seeing this happen. So that's what we need to be capitalizing and building on. I really do think that Democrats and like liberals in this country spend way too much time agonizing over Donald Trump and not enough time thinking strategically about how, what the action should be and how to be proactive in engaging voters and people consistently instead of just being reactive to his shenanigans. Because reacting to his shenanigans legitimizes what he's doing and saying at a time when, I'm not saying that we should ignore it, but there needs to be some approach that is really strategic and cognizant of what he's actually doing instead of trying to act like we can play the same game with him. Like folks think they're playing checkers and I think they're playing chess, and they're playing like Chinese checkers. Like, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, Tan Rawl, I mean, actually, if you took a survey of the American people and asked them, how many of you care about Elizabeth Warren's ancestry? I think the number would be somewhere between 0.00000005% and all those zeros plus a six. In other words, almost no one. And yet this is the issue right now that the Democrats and Elizabeth Warren have handed back to Donald Trump.
Well, I mean, I see a lot of the mistakes of Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2016 starting to come to the surface. And in Elizabeth Warren's candidacy, Elizabeth Warren, first and foremost, is going to have to answer to the Bernie Sanders supporters for the fact that she endorsed Hillary Clinton and not Bernie Sanders in 2016. They haven't forgotten that. That's going to be a far bigger issue for her than her Native American ancestry. So I don't think spending is going to make any difference. And you know who proves that? Donald Trump. He was outspent 6-1 by Hillary Clinton. He still won. So spending doesn't mean much. It didn't even mean much to Donald Trump. He ran a new kind of insurgency against Hillary Clinton's establishment campaign. But in 2020, he's going to be the establishment. And so what the Democrats need is an insurgent candidate who's radical and has an unabashedly progressive leftist message that's going to present a clear alternative to what the Republicans are pushing in terms of warmongering and raping the poor and insulting women, as Trump did today in his tweet about Stormy Daniels, and so on. There just needs to be a we need to learn the lessons of 2016. It doesn't seem to me like the DNC has learned that lesson.
Anoa Cheng, I know you have to run, so we're going to give you your last word, and then we'll take it back to Ted Rawl. I'm just looking at some other polls. The public is split over whether they think Trump will win a second term. I don't know if any of this actually matters, but 46% say he will, and 47% say he won't. But that's a steep improvement for him since March, when 54% of adults said they thought he'd lose his bid for a second term. If anything, it seems to me that Donald Trump has become in many ways normalized, even by the opposition. The opposition, at least the elite opposition, has fired in the wrong direction. And Donald Trump, in some ways, to the extent that the economy is not crashing right now and other things are happening that please the big bankers and big corporate barons, Donald Trump is doing all right. Anyway, what's your take on that? And then we'll let you go because I know you're running.
No, definitely appreciate getting a chance to join the conversation today. Really appreciate when you guys reach out. But what I will say is I don't know if that if those numbers come from the same poll that says that Joe Biden is like the number one presidential pick right now for Democrats. Because, you know, if that's that same CNN poll, it's riddled with issues, including the fact that I think it only interviewed like people over 45 and white. So again, we're already been seeing, I mean, we saw this in 2016, we're seeing it pan out some now. No one thought Andrew Gillum was going to win. The polls aren't really telling an accurate story. I know they need to still keep the shtick up because they need to, you know, still keep their monopoly and make their money. But like we have seen so many examples in the past 2 years of how the polling is just not accurate. And so I just believe that we continue to build what we've been building. We've seen upsets. We're seeing upsets happen. I mean, we might actually have a Democratic governor here in Georgia who did not run as a Dixiecrat, right? So like if we do have that, it's because of the investment in people and the issues that are mattering to our communities across the board, making sure working class, regardless of race, regardless of gender, have the means and access they need. I mean, that's what people right now are really starving for. But we're 10 years after the financial crash. This is the type of leadership we need to be seeing and nurturing and involving ourselves in. And hopefully Democrats will like learn that lesson and we won't get stuck with Trump or one of his minions for another 4 years. So I will bid you all my leave, and thank you so much for having me today.
Okay, that's the voice of Anoa Changa. She's the director of political advocacy and a managing editor of Progressive Army. She's the host of the show The Way with Anoa. Thank you, Anoa. We're going to turn back to Ted Rawl. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work at rawl.com. Ted, I saw a poster you made for Facebook. I really, really liked it. I was laughing out loud early in the morning when I woke up too early, which is every morning. It said something like, everybody who I hate in the future, I'm going to tell them to go visit the Saudi consulate in Istanbul.
Yeah, well, I hate to chuckle about this story because, I mean, it is absolutely disgusting what almost certainly happened to Jamal Khashoggi. And it's shocking. But another tweet I sent out later today, the same day, was, You know that you're in trouble as the Saudi government when your backup story is that you were torturing the guy with an intent to kidnap him and send him to Saudi Arabia, and he died in that process.
We didn't mean to cut him up. We didn't mean to cut him up.
It was an accident.
A rogue autopsy.
Yeah, the rogue guys did it. It's absolutely insane.
It's insane, but here you have, again, in the election cycle, and, you know, I'm not really the one to do the election cycle stories, truthfully, but John is not here. So, but in the election, we have a situation where the Republican Party is actually fighting against itself. Marco Rubio and Lindsey Graham want to bring down the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman. Trump is defending him, saying, yeah, it was just a rogue killing. They didn't mean to do it. As you said, they just meant to interrogate him and kidnap him, not to interrogate him and kill him and cut him into small pieces. But there is a division inside the Republican Party. But again, on foreign policy issues, there's no real fundamental strategic or in even largely tactical difference between the Democrats and the Republicans over, say, the issue like Saudi Arabia. Because the fact of the matter is, as terrible as what has happened to this journalist, what's happened to the people in Yemen is like by a magnitude of many, many thousands that much greater. And you hear hardly a peep from the Democrats or support for the Democrats for the strategic alliance with the Saudi royal family. And even Bernie Sanders, if you remember in the 2016 campaign, when he was saying the U.S. should start to disengage from the Middle East, I think he was saying, yeah, we should rely more on our allies like Saudi Arabia at that time. I think he's more critical of Saudi Arabia now. Anyway, let's talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's certainly true that this highlights the, you know, the fact that the United States is really not as much of a superpower as it likes to think, right? I mean, if the Saudis say jump, we jump because we're afraid they're going to tank the economy, stop buying our overpriced weapon systems, and stop fighting a proxy war against the Iranians in Yemen, and so on. The Saudis really are yanking our chain, and or I should say the U.S. government's chain, and it's all segments of the GOP as well as the Democratic Party. As you said, the only real conflict is which branch of the Saudi royal family is each party more fond of. But they're not like really, nobody questions the basic assumption. And yet, what's interesting about it is the oil keeps flowing, right? You don't have to be an American citizen to get a special deal on oil. You know, if you live in Belgium or Botswana, or in Cambodia, you get oil. The oil's the same price. It's just on the world market. So why is it that the United States has to play the Saudis game? I'm not really clear on that point. It seems to me like the Saudis need to sell their oil. Their one trick pony is the only. Their economy is not diverse. It's all they can do is sell oil. So it seems to me like the pressure should be able to work both ways at least, and yet it doesn't.
Ted Rall is our guest. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work at rall.com. Okay, we talked a little bit about Elizabeth Warren. John Kiriakou, welcome.
Hey, thank you. It's good to be back.
Hey, John.
We're glad. Hi. I wanted you here in the beginning of the show because it's about elections and the election cycle.
Yes, indeed.
And you are, instead of me, the person who should be doing this.
And I actually have a lot to tell you.
Okay, so look, we're going to talk to John Kiriakou and Ted Rall in our last minutes. I want to talk about the Democratic field a little bit.
Yes.
We have Elizabeth Warren, who has intervened right now to announce that she did a DNA test, which Donald Trump is beating her up about, and I think quite successfully. The other possible Democratic contenders, Bernie Sanders, of course, Kamala Harris, Joe Biden seems to be number one among the Democratic field. I don't know. I just don't think these people, given the nature of the Democratic Party right now, and the way things are going, I don't think any of them really, it seems to me, beat Donald Trump. What's your view, John? And then let's ask Ted Rall what he thinks.
I agree. And I have just come from a 2-hour meeting with a very senior Republican Party campaign operative who also agrees with what you just said. She said that the president is licking his chops to face any one of these top-ranking Democrats so far. Now, of course, we're so early in the presidential election process that everything that we see in the polls is a function of name recognition at this point. So there can be a breakout candidate that we're not really focusing on right now. It's likelier that someone who is well-known will win just because that's how the system is set up with the superdelegates and the early ability to raise money. But yeah, I don't see any of these top 4 or 5 Democrats beating Donald Trump.
Well, you know, here's the thing, Ted, from my point of view, I mean, it is way too early to tell. And it's 2 years out and plus. But, you know, Bernie Sanders, when he was running as an insurgent candidate in 2016, when he was running against Hillary Clinton, not just against the Republicans later, 80% of the young people who voted in the Democratic primaries and voted enthusiastically. Sanders was having rallies of tens of thousands of people night after night in New York City before the New York City primary and in other places all around the country. It seemed like an insurgent campaign. But then Bernie Sanders, at the end of the day, folded the tent and supported Hillary Clinton, the neoliberal, neoconservative Hillary Clinton, who the rest of the country was rejecting and who certainly young, radical-minded people rejected. It sort of took away the elan of Bernie Sanders. And lately, the foreign policy positions, as Sanders is trying to define them, sound really like the foreign policy of any other empire politician in many ways. I mean, with some tactical tweaks. I, again, don't see how that amounts to an insurgent campaign, which is actually what would be necessary in the face of Donald Trump. Anyway, that's my view. What do you think, Ted?
Yeah, I agree with you guys. I think none of these candidates have a great chance at this stage. If I had to handicap it in terms of with this particular field, who would I go with if I were picking, if I were the emperor of the Democratic Party, I would pick Sanders again, just because there would be a lot of disgruntled Sanders supporters from 2016 who would like to see a do-over, who fantasized of what would have happened if their candidate had been running against Trump instead of Donald Trump. I think you'd still see a lot of excitement. I see the Bernie 2020 stickers all over the place these days. So I think that the bloody shirt argument could work strong. And after that, I'd probably be looking at a Kamala Harris, maybe. I think she's extremely establishmentarian and not at all an insurgent and to the right on a lot of issues. But she doesn't, as we saw in the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings for the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh, she does have a certain charisma that is undeniable on television. And that counts for a lot, too.
We have 2 minutes left, John. I mean, Joe Biden is 75. Bernie Sanders right now is 77. Mm-hmm. Elizabeth Warren, 69.
John Kerry, 72.
Yeah. I mean, again, everybody knows these people. Like, mm-hmm. Trump came in as an insurgent, like a right-wing populist insurgent. I mean, the Democratic Party would have to feel like an insurgent organization against Trump, but not just against Trump, against the lack of good jobs and the fact that people can't go to the doctor and all those kind of things.
That's right.
But the Democratic Party seems to me to be so wedded to Wall Street that it won't do that.
I think Ted Rall is right about Kamala Harris. I think she's a very attractive candidate. She's able to raise money. She's from California, the most populous state in the country. And she's a former attorney general and prosecutor. So we know from the Kavanaugh hearings, we know from her own Senate campaign that she's good on the campaign trail. I'm assuming she's going to be able to raise a lot of money, so I think we should be taking her seriously. But otherwise, you're right. The Democratic Party is the party of Wall Street. It's been the party of Wall Street since 1992, maybe earlier. And that's something that is not going to be easily shaken off.
Ted Rall, you get the last word, 30 seconds.
Yeah, it's a damn shame, right? I mean, we're constantly being told that we have the that we Americans, voters, get the government that we deserve. But how is it that when we go to this restaurant and there's only two dishes on the menu and they're both terrible, how is it that we deserve a terrible meal? I blame the chef, not the person dining at the restaurant.
Yeah. Remember, the lesser of two evils is still evil.
Indeed. That was Ted Rall. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work at rall.com. Earlier, we were joined by Anoa Changa. She talked to us from Atlanta, Georgia. Anoa is the director of political advocacy and a managing editor of Progressive Army and the host of the show, The Way with Anoa. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Today we continue our weekly series. We do this every Tuesday called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. We're joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. He is a financial policy analyst. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel, I was struck by an article that was in the Wall Street Journal this morning. It's the front page. The headline in the hard copy is a little bit different than on the electronic copy. On the hard copy, it reads, "Deficit swells as tax cuts take bite." Now, that kind of says it clearly. It's about the tax cuts. The headline on the online version is, "U.S. government deficits grew 17% in fiscal 2018. And then in a subtitle, a real little tiny subtitle, tax cuts have restrained revenue gains. I mean, that's a big difference in headlines because one is, oh, it's been a restraint. It's a small issue. Where here in the main headline of the Wall Street Journal, a hard copy is, yeah, the reason the deficit is swelling in the middle of an economic expansion when it would be expected to shrink is because of the tax plan, Donald Trump's tax plan. Anyway, let's talk about that.
Yeah, this is an important article to discuss a little bit about. The federal deficit has grown larger than it has in the last 6 years, like I mentioned, up 17%. And the Wall Street Journal is pointing out that it, you know, may have something to do with the GOP tax plan, which was passed recently. And that's certainly the case. I think one of the interesting parts of the story is when we have economic growth, when there's economic expansion, like we certainly do, we see an increase in revenue because there's all this increased profitability. And so tax revenue flows in. And that's, of course, what Donald Trump promised, right? He kept saying, oh, my gosh, we're going to have so much growth that it won't even matter that we've had all these tax cuts. These tax cuts are going to pay for themselves and then some. But actually what we're seeing is a new economic phenomena, which is that the revenues are shrinking while we're in the midst of an economic boom cycle, which doesn't normally happen. In fact, that's very uncommon. And I think the Wall Street Journal points that out. And why is that? I think there's two really important points. One, the Wall Street Journal puts front and center. The other one, they kind of brush over more quickly. The first is that the GOP tax cuts were so significant, so immense, and reduced tax revenue so severely that even though there's an increase in profitability, even though there's an economic upswing, it still can't make up for the fact that there's these huge tax cuts. It still can't make up for the fact that there's a cut to federal income. So that's a huge part of it. The tax cuts were just massive. It's kind of hard to overstate that. But secondarily, and this the Wall Street Journal kind of brushes over, is the military spending. We, of course, recently passed a multi-billion dollar spending budget, $589.5 billion for the Pentagon's base budget, and another $65.2 billion for overseas counterinsurgency operations. And this is a bipartisan effort. It was nearly unanimously supported by both parties. There were a few dissenters, but not enough to make a difference. And both Republicans and Democrats signed on to it. We are spending an immense amount of money on the military. And it has been really for the benefit of, you know, war contractors and companies like Raytheon, and at the detriment of our own civil society, which is running out of money because we're pouring so much into this military budget so we can go overseas and, you know, bomb women and children in some foreign land. So both of these are causing the deficit to swell incredibly, even in the midst of an economic upturn. And so it's a really kind of unique phenomenon right now that we're observing.
That's the voice of Daniel Sankey, financial policy analyst. We talk to Daniel every Tuesday on this segment here at Loud and Clear. We're talking about the big economic issues of the day, as we do every Tuesday with Daniel. Daniel, let's think about this for a moment. What Donald Trump did by lowering taxes, mainly for the rich, but they were kind of across the board. As you went down the income ladder, the tax cuts became more and more minuscule. Still, people, if you have a couple hundred dollars more in your bank account, even if it's just a couple hundred, if you're very low income, you appreciate that. These were big tax cuts. And, you know, before they did the tax cuts, the Republicans, as part of their main mantra, main sort of message, was that the budget in the U.S. government, the deficit in the U.S. government was so terrible because we were leaving future generations, our grandchildren, with this terrible gaping debt that would saddle them and make economic prosperity impossible. That was the definite message of the Republicans. But they were using it to say, that's why we should cut Medicare. That's why we should cut Social Security or Medicaid or money for education or housing, the things human beings actually need. Now, what Donald Trump did and what the Republicans did with the support of enough Democrats as well is carry out a big government financial stimulus program, not for the working class, not for the poor, not for the low-income people, but for the very, very rich through the medium of a massive tax cut. It was a financial stimulus program. Now the Republicans, I'm certain, will say, well, look, we have this huge deficit. Now we have to find a way to bring it down so that our future generations aren't saddled with this terrible debt. So let's cut Medicaid, let's cut Medicare, let's cut education. In other words, a self-fulfilling prophecy. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there's a really important part of that, though, that you didn't mention. And so how it goes is, oh, there's this huge deficit. We can't afford it anymore, right? We can't afford these schools. We can't afford healthcare. But for some reason, we can afford the hundreds of billions of dollars to the military. That's not a problem. Nobody's sitting there wringing their hands saying, oh, we have to cut military spending. We have to cut the Pentagon's budget. Can't do it with all this debt. That's off the table. That's simply not up for discussion. But Medicaid, education, things that promote human life as opposed to destroy it, these things are always on the chopping block. But here's how the strategy goes. So what you do is you cut spending to, say, education. So class size grows. So teachers are more overwhelmed, more under-resourced, more unable to provide the sort of education that they're supposed to. And then you start complaining the schools are terrible, that they're awful, that nobody learns anything. The class sizes are out of control. And these teachers are terrible. And so why do you do that? Well, you do that so then you can make the final step, which is to say all these publicly owned services, all these services that are kind of guaranteed to us as citizens, need to become privatized. They need to become put in the hands of some sort of private entity so that they can get these services for pennies on the dollar because they're just so terrible and they're just so inefficient and incompetent. And then they can start profiting off of it because these public services are public in part because they're necessary. Everybody needs an education. People can't go around illiterate. People can't go around not understanding basic mathematics. They're necessary. Or Medicare. The human condition is such that we will get sick. That is guaranteed. That is simply part of being a human being. And so these services need to be, the understanding was they need to be public because everybody needs them at some point. It's not a luxury that's somehow optional that you can kind of take or leave. If you can make these private, that means these private companies have guaranteed revenue streams. What are you going to do? Not get sick? Impossible. What are you going to do? Never get educated? Impossible. Life would be unable to be lived. So that's the end goal. The end goal is to take these long publicly owned institutions, these things that work, these things that provide for our communities, and make them private so that people like Betsy DeVos and others can reap huge profits at the expense of many people. That's where the language about the budget deficit comes in. That's where the rhetoric comes in. The truth is, of course, though, we could cut military spending. There seems to be hundreds of billions of dollars just sitting around there. And that would mean what? We didn't kill some people in Yemen. We didn't sell as many weapons to the Saudis so they couldn't murder women and children in Yemen. It would mean we couldn't sell as many weapons to so-called free Islamic State groups that are also committing to acts of terror over there in Syria. It would mean that we'd have to focus our resources on human beings here in the United States and promoting life rather than ending life overseas. But of course, that's not up for discussion. That's something that the Pentagon and the military contractors simply wouldn't allow to even be discussed. And that's why we're continuing to look at things like Medicaid and education as somehow a viable option to cut back on these services.
Daniel, the idea that the government could, through its own spending program, a stimulator of the economy, priming the pump, so to speak, that became a theory that was embraced by liberals. And of course, the New Deal, Roosevelt, the whole Keynesian concept that when the capitalist system came to a grinding or almost grinding halt after the stock market crash of October 1929, within a couple of years, we had a situation where 25% official unemployment, where thousands of people were literally starving to death every year. There was no unemployment insurance. There was no Social Security. There was no safety net. And so Roosevelt and the economists, the liberal economists around Roosevelt, argued that by providing a financial stimulus, by giving people money when people were unemployed, by giving them jobs, make work jobs, of course, many of the big roads and dams and important parts of the infrastructure were built by workers during those days who were publicly funded at very, very low wages. But nonetheless, they had a job. That was considered sort of trying to overcome the crisis of overproduction by increasing consumption. In other words, giving people money through jobs. The jobs could have significance or maybe not so much significance in some cases, but people would have money. They would spend the money that would get the economy going again. That's the whole sort of the basic core concept in a vulgarized version, no doubt, of Keynesian deficit spending as a stimulus. But here we have a stimulus program that's really just for the upper crust in the main, because all of the vitally needed social programs, and as you mentioned, healthcare, the Trump administration, with, I would say, in cahoots with the Congress, which includes, again, the going along with by the Democrats, it's just the opposite. It's a class, it's trying to overcome the crisis of overproduction, the boom-bust cycle, by giving money only to the capitalists or mainly to the capitalists or mainly to the already affluent.
Yeah, it's kind of Keynesian economics turned on its head. I mean, Keynes noticed something that was really important, and that was that workers both produce profitability through their own labor, but workers are also consumers. So if you're producing shoes and you're a shoe manufacturer and you want to make money, and the more shoes you sell, the more money you make, well, you're going to need people who buy shoes. But the problem is, if you have cut wages so significantly across the board, people can't afford to buy your shoes. So you can't sell your shoes, so you end up going out of business. And it becomes this vicious cycle of people not having enough money to stimulate the economy so that more and more companies cut back on wages so that there's less to stimulate the economy, et cetera. And what Keynes noticed was, hey, if we start dumping spending in, if we start providing jobs for people, even if they are kind of lower wage federal jobs building up infrastructure, then there's suddenly going to be this working class with more disposable income, and they're going to buy those shoes or whatever, and it's going to stimulate the economy. It's really trickle-up economics, and it worked very effectively. Now, obviously, we don't need to create roadways, and the auto manufacturing industry isn't what it used to be, but there's still a tremendous amount of infrastructure we need fixed. It's crumbling. It's falling apart. We need to convert to renewable energy. We need to convert to safe roads and bridges and such to take people around the country. There's a ton of work for people to be done, and a government spending program could absolutely put these people to work again, much like it did when we built all of our roadways in the 50s and built all during the big economic expansion kind of at the on the automobile. So that's absolutely an option. But now what we're seeing is that in reverse. And what we're saying is it's trickle down, that somehow, no, we're not going to give more spending power to workers. We're going to give more spending power to corporations. And somehow that'll work. Somehow corporations will buy those shoes that everyone's supposed to buy or buy all those Teslas that everyone's supposed to be excited about. But of course, this doesn't happen because that's not how it works. These major capitalist enterprises are owned by a very tiny group of people. And while those group of people will spend money, they can't match the, you know, rest of the vast majority of society who will be buying those shoes and cars, et cetera. And so our economy continues to spiral, continues to flounder, and we continue to hike up this budget deficit, and rather than spending it on things like infrastructure or jobs, we're spending it on war, on militarism. And really, yeah, it is kind of Keynesianism in reverse.
You know, another thing, we're just going to round this part out because I know we have a number of other issues that we want to talk about. The Rooseveltian Keynesian program, the New Deal program of the 1930s, which wasn't just a gift from Roosevelt. I mean, Roosevelt said when he was trying to answer his capitalist critics who thought this was communism to have unemployment insurance, he said, I'm trying to save capitalism here. I mean, he was quite explicit about it because the danger of socialism or the danger of revolution was ever present. But while that priming of the pump, the deficit spending, the government being sort of the stimulus when the rest of the private sector capitalist economy had collapsed or was paralyzed, that actually ran out of steam in 1937. And there was another wave of economic contraction or another depression, so to speak. And ultimately, the only way the U.S. economy got back on its feet after this capitalist Great Depression was the full 100% militarization of the economy as the country prepared to go to war in Europe and in Asia. Then all the unemployed were brought into the Army or the Navy or the Marines or the Air Corps. All of the factories started humming again. As men went in the main off to war, women, their wives, were given industrial jobs. And as a consequence, finally, the capitalist economy in the United States came out of the doldrums, came out of depression, but it was only really through the instrument of full-scale militarization. Something to keep in mind when we have discussions like this, because whether the stimulus package is for the poor, the workers, the low income, or for the very, very rich, it can tweak, it can have an impact on the basic features of capitalism, but it doesn't actually overcome the basic laws of capitalism that every 7, 8, 10, 11 years plunge the country, the economy, and perhaps the world economy into another huge depression with all of that attendant human suffering.
Yeah, that is a central feature of how the system works, the boom-bust cycle. Because our economy is anarchistic, that is to say, we produce not in coordination with each other, but as individual private enterprises, which all have a different idea of how much they can sell and how much they need to make, we inevitably produce more than we need because we're not a planned economy and we're not coordinated. It's chaos and it's randomness. And sometimes it comes together and it works and we have a big boom cycle. And then other times it doesn't. And then we have a big bust cycle. I also think that, you know, the military spending that kind of brought us out of that downturn in 1937, you know, we're continuing to spend on the military now, but really we're not seeing any sort of upturn. And that's largely due to the fact of how we produce weapons is largely automated and the weapons we use are largely automated. So even, you know, in midst of this new downturn, that strategy doesn't really work to preserve profitability because of how we manufacture things and how we transform things. So that's no longer really that much of an option either. I think that, you know, really if we look at it and we kind of tweak things and turn things and change policies, that no matter how you turn it and tweak it, you can have a gentler, kinder capitalism, but you can't have a capitalism that doesn't involve boom, bust, and the attendant consequences, which is joblessness, homelessness, poverty, desperation, etc. That is a fundamental feature of it. And so long as we produce wealth by a small group of individuals who make decisions entirely on their own and not in coordination, so long as the economy is anarchistically planned, we'll continue to see these sort of instability and the problems that it creates.
Exactly. The same feature of capitalism, that is, its competition between enterprises, one expands, the other dies. That same dynamism that is always pointed to by the supporters of capitalism as the thing that allows capitalism to produce new products, more products, and cheaper products, that same function, the competition, the in many ways unmanaged competition because of the nature of competition, in other words, the anarchistic, unplanned character of the mega or meta economy, that same feature that leads to its dynamism also leads to these massive depressions with tens of millions of people losing jobs through no fault of their own, or in the case of the last great recession, 9 million families being put into foreclosure, 3 million actually losing their homes. Daniel Sankey is our guest. We talk to Daniel every Tuesday in this segment called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism. Daniel, let's go on to some of our other stories. We have about four or five more and only about 10 minutes left. Let's keep going then.
Absolutely. So one of the ones I wanted to bring up was a Wall Street Journal article which talks about tariff hits those Trump wants to help in U.S. factories. And what it's talking about is that the trade war that Trump has kicked off by imposing tariffs on China has then caused, of course, China to retaliate and impose its own tariffs on U.S. Goods. And what's happening is that's causing the tariffs on U.S. goods to make them no longer as competitive as they once were. They create a lot of inputs in China, and they are sold in China, and it's hurting the businesses that export to China and hurting the jobs here as well, hurting the jobs here in the United States as well. Really, what it talks about is this trade war against China has no winner. That one country enacts tariffs, the other one is forced to do the same to try to counter them because at that point it's back against the wall. And really, at the end of the day, you know, Trump or the, you know, very wealthy factory owners, et cetera, aren't the ones that get hurt. It's the factory workers that get hurt. They want these different factories want to expand or at least maintain profitability, wanted perhaps to take advantage of this tax plan and add more jobs. And now because their products are no longer competitive by artificial Chinese tariffs, they're unable to do such things. And the workers, the factory workers that Trump championed as kind of the little guys that he would stick up for, are the ones that are getting hurt for it. So I think it's really important that we kind of look at this, kind of integrated global economy, because right now Trump likes to characterize China as the, you know, the big evil, the bully in the room that's stealing all of our jobs and taking advantage of all of our economy. When in truth, really, China right now is just kind of desperately fighting for its life against U.S. tariffs. And in the end, who is getting hurt are factory workers both here and abroad who are seeing their jobs and their livelihoods reduced because of the inflation of these tariffs.
Okay, Daniel, let's keep going. We have about 7 minutes. What's our next story?
So we have another story that I wanted to bring up was talking about foreign aid. And there was a discussion in the Wall Street Journal, Trump embraces foreign aid to counter China's global influence. And really, it was interesting because I think it showed a really kind of important shift in how foreign aid is being used. As I'm sure some of our listeners are aware, Trump was very much against foreign aid. He thought all the money should stay here in America and only go to aid American workers, and we shouldn't be assisting other countries. But what's happening is China has actually been quite generous in reaching out to other countries and providing foreign aid to them in an effort to cement better economic relationships with them and to really benefit their economies and their peoples there. So what we've seen is really a growing influence in China with these other countries. And I think it's important to point it out because when the United States engages countries economically, it is almost always from a position of kind of bullying, superiority, superior military strength and economic strength and pressure to push those countries into giving the U.S. what it wants. It's kind of a modern neocolonialism. China, because it's, you know, military strength is so much less than the United States, and its overall posture is so different, really has to go into these deals in a more or less position of equality where they have to give to get, and they really have to provide significant, substantial things to those countries that those countries can benefit from, such as roads or infrastructure, for example. And what's interesting about this article is it's showing that even the Trump administration, even in spite of his rhetoric, is being forced to acknowledge the effectiveness of the stance and how the U.S., there is a somewhat of a slipping of its kind of economic dominance in the face of China going into these different regions and saying, you know, hey, we're willing to make a deal. Let's work together, where just as the U.S. is starting to pull out its foreign aid. So this is kind of a reverse course. He was signed over $60 billion in loans and loan guarantees recently. It was done with very little fanfare because, of course, he doesn't want to be seen as somehow, you know, caring about foreign nations or wanting to, you know, invest in them in any sort of significant way. It's America first, of course. And so this is an interesting shift in U.S. posture because it shows that there is some power and influence in China to sort of check some of our aggression. I don't want to overstate it. Obviously, we're the 800-pound gorilla in the room. We have the largest military in the world, and we're willing to use it, et cetera. But there is a checking of our power from China's strategy overseas in these different countries.
Speaking of the U.S. and Africa, you see a Melania Trump's pith helmet there?
Oh, no, I did not.
Yeah, she dressed up as a British colonialist and went to Africa to find out how everybody was doing.
Wow.
Yeah, it was amazing. That was tangential. Daniel, we don't have to really talk about her pith helmet, but it really, that I was just thinking, you know, all the people who are attacking China, here you have the United States and the Europeans who colonized Africa, enslaved Africans, millions and millions of people, treated Africa as just a source of extraction. And here China's coming along, and whatever one thinks about China, they're actually offering African countries a better deal because China's foreign policy in Africa or elsewhere isn't motivated or driven, I should say, by corporations that must make maximum profits on every deal. What China is actually trying to do is secure access to resources for a rapidly burgeoning economy that is, you know, for one quarter of the human race. And they're not driven by corporate making each corporation, each enterprise making better and bigger profits. And thus they're able to offer better deals than U.S. and Western firms. That's actually what's going on in short.
That's exactly right. And I think that, you know, you mentioned the pith helmet. I think that's just a perfect example of that sort of colonial attitude that we carry, that we want these countries to know who's in charge. We don't even want to respect your culture in a very basic way by not wearing something like that. And you can see why these countries would look at a country like China and think, huh, maybe that's a better deal. Maybe these people actually care a little bit more about us.
Let's go on to the Sears bankruptcy, which, you know, for people of a certain age, at least, the idea that Sears and Roebuck could be bankrupt and all of its stores closed, almost unimaginable.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, to put it in context for maybe a more modern audience, imagine Apple going out of business. That's kind of what it would be like. It would be like this giant that you could never, ever imagine going out of business. It was just a bedrock of the United States economy suddenly running out of money. And that was Sears and Roebuck. Sears and Roebuck have gone out of business. They've declared Chapter 11 bankruptcy, which is huge. People kind of saw this coming. The writing was sort of on the wall, and it's sort of been circulating for a while. You know, this represents a huge loss of retail jobs that a lot of people depended on, and a huge loss of backshop jobs as well. I mean, a lot of people are going to lose their jobs and are going to be left with very little. More than that, though, it shows that a company like Sears, this massive American institution that's been around for decades and decades, that had its fingers in nearly every type of commodity, if it's going out of business because brick and mortar aren't a viable option anymore, if that transformation of our economy can hit Sears so hard, then it really is bad for all brick and mortar businesses. And it really questions whether they can keep making it in the world, or if really more and more companies like Amazon are going to be taking that place where workers are much less needed and much more exploited than these front-end retail jobs.
Daniel, let me just jump in there because I want to mention Amazon. We have about 2 minutes left. Amazon, you know, gave that $15 an hour raise to workers. Bernie Sanders said it was great, showed the company was listening. It turns out that a lot of Amazon workers are so angry because, in fact, as they gave everyone a $15 an hour raise, around Amazon warehouses around the country, many longtime workers are angry based on the information that they've received so far. I'm looking at the New York Times. Yes, Amazon is increasing wages, which will benefit many employees, but it will no longer give out new stock grants and monthly bonuses. Some workers, meaning the workers who have been there for a while, believe this means that their total compensation will actually shrink. And then there's comments from these workers who say, yeah, here comes the holidays and we're actually taking a pay cut. And again, Amazon harvested so much good relations based on raising workers' wages, but they, with one hand they gave, the other hand they took back. Again, you have Jeff Bezos, though, the owner, who just, by the way, is bidding for a $10 billion contract with the Pentagon on top of his $600 million contract with CIA. His, quote, worth is $166 billion because of the work of these workers. Anyway, take us out. We have about 30 seconds left.
I think really you have to ask yourself, how does Jeff get that much money? And he doesn't get it by giving raises to workers. So that's not how Amazon has become a giant. If Amazon is giving raises to workers, they're making money somewhere else. And in this case, they're making more money because I'll tell you, the stock options and those grants are probably worth more than that raise. So they're taking back the bonuses, and that's how these companies do it. So, you know, definitely don't believe it. They're not here to help people. They're not here to help workers and provide jobs. They're here to maximize profit. And anytime it looks like they're not doing it, you have to read the fine print and look at the bottom of the article because there's more to the story.
Time to make Amazon public property, not Jeff Bezos property.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm part of that expropriation without compensation movement. Have you heard of it?
I have heard of it. I'm a fan as well.
Okay, excellent. Anyway, that was Daniel Sankey, financial policy analyst. He talks to us every Tuesday in this segment called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.